where Jeff, my co-host, and I chat with popular science authors about how they take complex science topics and make them engaging and compelling and understandable for the general public. Today, we will talk about the biotech revolution and how it can benefit or possibly be a detriment to humans and your animals. And with that, I'd like to introduce a pair of authors who have written the book called How to Defeat Your Own Clone and Other Tips for Surviving the Biotech Revolution, which takes a look at genetic engineering, synthetic biology, other biological enhancements, and how they are perceived in popular culture and possibly misrepresented, and they go about dispelling those common misconceptions.
That means I get to introduce Emily Anthes, who describes herself as a journalist who likes to tell stories about science, which I think is real cool because stories about science is one of the best things, and that's what we like to do. And I was very interested to read that Emily has an actual master's degree in science writing, which I think is a really cool thing because I don't think degrees in science writing existed in prehistoric times when I was in school. Her stories have appeared in all the big name outlets that you would expect, and I wrote down some names like Wired and Scientific American and Slate and the Boston Globe, and I am green with envy because she has even been on Fresh Air, and so I might want to hear about that. Her biggest story so far is her book Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts, which is right here on the shelf behind me in green. Welcome, Emily. And
hey, Jeff, I didn't properly introduce both the authors because they're just like a pair, a nebulous pair.
Well,
they orbit around each other, I think. They aren't individuals.
They're very nebulous.
So Terry, who just spoke there, is a bioengineering lecturer at UC Berkeley, who has his hands in all sorts of projects, including as an advisor for the iGEM synthetic biology team there, making him incredibly analogous to me at the University of Illinois. Anyway, he's quite witty and does a pretty darn good job of explaining things, so you find anything he's written or any sort of video, you'll enjoy it. Kyle is also a bioengineer, and I believe these guys both met at Berkeley. And he believes the public misconception of science and technology is a troubling, if not dangerous, thing. And hence, that's why he's so excited to share, clear things up for the rest of us.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
There you go. And I think we all agree about science illiteracy being a big problem. So here I'm back pretending that I've just introduced Emily.
Okay.
And my first softball question. And this comes about because I'm the one playing the Dr. Watson in this episode because I'm the physical scientist. So I'm the one who gets to ask the stupid questions so y'all can explain things. And I think a good place for me to start is to say, hey, when we're talking about biotech, what is it that we're talking about? Emily.
That's a simple question, but it's a hard one to answer. Mm-hmm. And that's something I sort of look at in the book, is trying to put these new powers we have in context. So when you say genetic engineering, normally in pop culture and in headlines when we say that, we mean sort of molecular level engineering, interfering with the cell level, the gene level, with tiny tools and petri dishes in labs. But there's a way in which genetic engineering, of course, is millennia old. When you look at sort of the artificial breeding we've done and how we've shaped dog breeds, that's also a form of genetic engineering. But in general, biotech refers to sort of the new arsenal of molecular techniques that we now have that allows us to control life and organisms with much more precision than we've had in the past. Mm-hmm. I'm not a bioengineer, so maybe I should turn the question over to those guys.
Or I can, you know, interpolate and say, so Kyle, am I wrong in thinking that it generally is some sort of like engineering with life and that usually DNA or something is involved here?
Yeah, from a scientific perspective, I think Emily actually hit it pretty well. generally biotechnology is referring to those new genetic tools and sort of manipulating things on the gene level and even the cell level. Sometimes the term does get applied more broadly to things like medical devices and just any technology mm-hmm. that relates to health or biology in general, although that's not really the proper term to use. So Emily really did kind of sum it up nicely there.
Good to know.
We're waiting to see if you want to add anything, Terry.
we come as one. We're a group, Terry.
Okay. So that been answered from over there.
I would be in agreement. I think historically, the sort of medical technologies initially were accidental. I mean, there were things like brewing, where mm-hmm. brewing occurs because there are things like yeast and bacteria all over the place. You didn't really have to understand the biology to take advantage of them. You had to sort of understand the process or repeat it. Modern biotechnology, I think, is predicated on the idea of using a deeper understanding of biology, a sort of post-genetic understanding of biology, mm-hmm. to intelligently apply biology to solve problems, and using these sort of molecular techniques to apply biology to solve problems that it hasn't been applied to before.
Very good. I think, both of your books, well, obviously Terry and Kyle's book is called How to Defeat Your Own Clone, and Emily's book pretty much jumps right in to talk about cloning. So why don't we talk a bit about cloning? And we'll start with Kyle and Terry. What are the most common misconceptions about cloning? And in that discussion, you can also tell us what cloning really is.
Sure. Maybe I'll jump since Terry was just talking last. But we do have a whole chapter in our book about the misconceptions, and I think that was really one of the primary reasons that we wrote the book in the first place was because mm-hmm. When I got into grad school, I just started realizing more and more, especially within the area of bioengineering, and when you take things that are potentially contentious and that people don't really understand, then all these misconceptions arise. So I would say, just the biggest one for me, I think, in writing the book was just simply that clones are going to be exactly the same. Like, they're going to look exactly the same as the original organism. They're going to act exactly the same as the original organism. That would be flat out not true. Just from what we know in terms of biology, a clone would really be more like an identical twin, and really an identical twin that's probably born at a much different date. So looking at the clones that actually exist in terms of animals and the historical cloning that's been done, it really just looks like a sort of a baby twin of the original animal. And that's what we would really think of as real clones that might exist. So for me, that was the biggest misconception that we kind of tore down in the book. There's plenty more. Terry, you want to take one?
I don't know if it's the biggest misconception, but I think my favorite misconception is that if it's a clone, it's evil. That's all you need to know. Which to be totally honest, if you're twins, that's a serious problem with your self-image.
And Emily, your chapter did talk about the companies and the scientists who are trying to clone animals, including pets, not just farm animals, mm-hmm. And that they aren't the same. They look different. And this could be a disappointment to someone who maybe wants to clone a beloved pet, that they might not be the same.
Right.
In different ways, many ways.
And the researchers who got involved in sort of some of these commercial pet cloning efforts were actually concerned about this. They thought people might misunderstand what cloning was, and pet cloning is still very expensive. You can get your dog cloned in Korea, but it's six figures. And researchers are worried that people might think they're getting the same dog back, that, the dog will have the same memories, which, of course, is preposterous, but even the dog might not look the same. I mean, one of the most interesting things about cloning is because clones are care-determined surrogate mothers, they're not even in the same prenatal environment that their genetic donors were. So in addition to being born at a different time, they've been developed in a different womb, and with all we now know and are learning about epigenetics, that can lead to all sorts of differences in how the clone turns out.
All of you say, and it's a very good thing worth saying, that cloning is not the same as duplicating. And there are different facts that are true here, like the memory clone that Kyle and Terry talk about, but and also the dogs, the pets, and the whole fact that it's a DNA match, but it's not all of the memories, the experience, the scars, and things that happened with being. Where did that idea come from? Was that just bad Hollywood, or did we, did we once think that, well, if we could take these cells and clone it, we'd get the perfect match and everything is reductionist, and we would end up with, you know, a 43-year-old who was exactly the same as this 43-year-old donor over here? You know, from my left to right, it's like Emily goes first.
I'm sure Hollywood played a role, and, you know, that's clearly part of it, but I think even science media and even responsible science journalists, I'm sure, had a small role, at least, in perpetuating that. When you have things like Dolly's born and you need a quick, snappy headline, I mean, it's easy to make a lot of the fact that we've made an exact copy of this sheep, and when you try and simplify some of these things for the general public and in various sorts of media, I think it's easy to leave people with that misconception.
I think that's right. I agree that sometimes sensationalized headlines are responsible for some of the misconception. The guys comment on this.
Kyle?
Yeah, am I next in the left to right?
Sure.
I totally agree. I think Hollywood may have the most dramatic effect in terms of some of those misconceptions, but I agree. I think the media in general and the way that the media portrays it, that all comes into play. So you get different sides and different aspects from the different sources. Some of them are more sensationalized than others. I don't think that, you know, there's a lot of biologists, hopefully none out there, that really had thought that I'm going to take this biological cloning process and, you know, birth a 43-year-old baby. I think that's rare, if it happens at all. I think scientists do have a good understanding, and it really is more about how that understanding is then converted and portrayed to the public.
I would say, especially something like genetics, it's an extremely powerful concept because we've been wrestling with what the hell am I for millennia, right? So why am I this way? It's been a philosophical question. And then you have something like genetics, which, to be honest, we've had not that long to really grapple with as a society. So trying to figure out what it means and what it doesn't mean is something that scientists are grappling with. What diseases are genetic? What diseases have a genetic component? How much of a particular disease can be correlated with genetics versus, you know, other things that are, you know, not focused on genetics. So I completely understand why this would be something that would be difficult for people to grapple with, because we're still working on what we think it actually means. I think that we need to be very careful as scientists, because I don't want to blame the media, even though I kind of half wrote a book about that. But as scientists, I think that it's important to sort of engage with these ideas from the point of view of a non-scientist. Like, as a scientist, you're going to be really, really focused on the fraction of correlation of this particular gene that I've been working on for the past 3 years. And it's very easy to just never, as a scientist, grapple with the big meaning of what you're talking about to people that are less interested about that particular gene and more interested in about what does this mean about me?
To my mind, when I was reading and thinking about these things and on both of all y'all's books, this struck me as a sort of parallel question. I don't know whether it will anyone else, but when I was in graduate school, around 1980, one of the big biology questions over here in this other department was all about cell differentiation. How is it that, you know, from this blastocyst, how is it that all of the heart cells go over here and make a heart, and how is it that all the liver cells go over here and make a liver? And that was the big question over there, and then I didn't pay any attention. And then sort of the next time I noticed, nobody's worrying about that as the central question of biology, because now we have the development of Evo-Devo as an understanding, and that it's about developmental approaches, and it's a much clearer picture, and it's supplanted that question with new questions, new ways of looking at things. And so I was wondering, have we not also, even if we didn't, you know, 30 years ago say, well, if I clone this person, it will be an exact duplicate at the moment the cells start growing, and therefore we'll have the same thoughts and everything. But was there something unspoken then that was a misconception that now has become much clearer, I think, perhaps in these 30 years, and when we have things like the emergence of this developmental idea as so central to how genes get expressed, and the fact that all this junk DNA actually is in large part the stuff that's turning things on and off is determining what these genes do and how they turn into proteins and how they actually make livers over here and hearts over here. Okay, it's an essay question.
No,
Terry, you were last, so we can go right to left on this one. But, has the picture changed underneath that just gives us a clearer understanding of what a clone actually would be?
I'm not sure that the picture has changed. I think that it's become higher resolution, where it used to be the idea was with the clone, if we take a small pipette and take the genetic stuff from one thing and put it in another thing, then we get another frog that looks like the original frog. And then you start having techniques where you're able to sequence the actual genetic material. You are beginning to understand what the differences are, that although you've put in genetic material with the same sequence, it may not have the same epigenetic modifications. Mm-hmm. Initially, you have this sort of crayon drawing of what you think is going on, and over time we've filled in a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that with a lot more detail, which just sort of, that's basically what I would say. I would say that the picture hasn't changed, it's that the details have become finer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think it hasn't changed that much. I think improvements in, obviously, you know, sequencing and computer science and sort of big data has changed biology a lot. And I think we have a better understanding of developmental biology, but the more we learn, we also learn that there's still a heck of a lot that we don't know. And some of those questions are so big and so complicated, like epigenetics and fetal environment and external factors and all of these things come into play. So I think, you know, to take an essay question and turn it into a short answer, we do have the understanding that you can take a genetic template, you can take a genome, and you can clone organisms, you know, for example, Dolly, and that does work. But there's so many little details that we don't fully understand yet that it's almost impossible for us to, you know, fully accurately model what the cloned organism is exactly going to be like. We have an idea that it'll be very similar, and certainly genetically, to the original organism, but all the other factors that come into play are very difficult to track so specifically.
I mean, to generalize maybe even further, because I'm a journalist and that's what I tend to do, I think, you know, one big change in the last 20 years is certainly the understanding that it's so much more than just the sequence of base pairs. You know, I think if you look back at like when the Human Genome Project launched, and there was this idea that all we have to do is figure out, you know, what, you know, the order is, A, T, C, you know, what the genetic sequence is, and that's all there is. And I think the more we study genetics and some of these, the more we do these technologies, the more we understand that the sequence is just the beginning, and there are all these other processes going on that modify expression and that have really profound effects. And I think that's something that wasn't appreciated 20 years ago, at least not to the extent that it is now.
So there's a big job here too, because the there's some excuse me, some level of genetic understanding has finally seeped into the public consciousness, so everyone walking down the street is instantly ready to say, oh, well, this can't be inherited. Show me the gene for that, because they finally caught up to the long not useful idea that every characteristic and trait that gets expressed has a gene someplace that is responsible for it. And now, you know, some of us, because I've read your books, know better than that, but how long is it going to take, Emily, before you get that message out to the average person on the street?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I feel like people have been trying to communicate that message for a long time. Just, this might be off topic a little bit, but as you were talking about that, I realized that I hadn't heard journalists or science communicators talk about genetic literacy in a while. It seems like the hot new topic is talking about oversimplifying neuroscience research. So that's everywhere, and talking about, you know, the brain region 4 and trying to get that message out there. I don't know if journalists and science communicators have moved on from genetics because maybe we think the public's gotten it by now. I don't know. I haven't heard anyone talk about that message in a long time, and I didn't realize that until you started talking about it.
That's actually very interesting. I'm going to agree with you on that, because there is the focus on the neuroscience. So I do want to, I guess, emphasize and maybe have you all agree, but the fear of having everything cloned is a bit misplaced, because the rate of creating a clone is just abysmal, right? It takes so many tries, and things have to be just right. So, and in fact, Emily's book had, you know, the numbers, like, you know, this is how many tries it took just to make this cloned puppy, right? And things like that. So if you want to comment on that, and then Kyle and Terry can comment, you know, are still people panicked that some evil genius is going to make a clone like the Boys of Brazil or something like that?
No, I mean, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, let Emily start.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, I was just going to say, despite the fact that Dolly was born in 1996, I mean, cloning, and there have been improvements in cloning, but it's still an experimental technology. It's still extremely immature, and there's a lot we don't know. It's inefficient. There are still defects that happen, probably because of errors in genetic reprogramming. I mean, it's not a mature technology that's ready sort of for prime time in terms of actually becoming a mainstream means of reproduction. That's not to say there can't and won't be improvements in the future, but I don't think we're close to it being mainstream yet.
Yeah, and I would say the fear around cloning humans is largely unsubstantiated right now, because it is very difficult. You can see that in the animal trials. You have all those failures before you get a success, and it's not allowed legally right now. So there's a variety of reasons that it probably just isn't going to happen in the near future. There's not even really great reasons that you would want to clone people. So it really would take sort of an isolated mad genius with unlimited funds and an island somewhere where he can ignore international laws. So the event seems rare, and maybe Terry, if you want to expound on that?
Just two things. One is, there, even if cloning technology were perfect, even if it worked 100% of the time, an animal's still got to carry the clone to term. It's not. I think it's important that people realize that cloning is something that works even worse than human reproduction, which is hard to do. And even if it did work that well, which I don't expect to see in my lifetime or, you know, probably several generations, that it's not as if clones are going to be pouring, one every 4 seconds out of tanks. That's just not how it works. I'd also like to say that, let's say that we are able to instantly clone someone. This would probably happen in the year 30,000 or so. If you were to do that, make a clone of some, you know, evil genius, there's no reason to expect that they would be evil.
Mm-hmm. Right. Except that they're a clone, which we know implies that they're evil. But now you come back to this question that I'm still wondering about, because when we watch, you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, we know that clones are grown in big tanks of bio something or other, and that they come out and, well, they look magnificent, and they're also, you know, 28 years old, because
they know how to use the bathroom. They
well, it's brain determinism, but there was that idea, and now it's fairly easy for, well, at least me, but I think for other people to accept that no, clones always involve a pregnancy. It's like, whoa, where did this whole developmental thing come from, which now is obvious sometimes, but still, I think it seems like a change in at least the popular understanding of how that works. It's kind of cool.
Well, it's interesting too that we always jump, or you know, society in general always jumps to the negative. I mean, even if you could get a clone that was exactly the same person, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've read about sort of course, we're going to have an army of Hitlers, but nobody's ever said, like, what about an army of Gandhis? Or, nobody ever talks about creating an army of great people. We immediately assume it's going to be all the evil people we clone. Mm-hmm.
There was an article from a bioethicist, and I wish I remember who this was, but the bioethicist was talking about the ethics of cloning people and changing their behavior, which you absolutely cannot do. But they were talking about what would be ethical to do. And his idea was, well, the only ethical thing that you could engineer people to do was to be more ethical. Which I found astounding.
Well, it's an ethicist talking, so...
So we've already spent a half hour talking about cloning, but you guys have touched on other topics. So I'd like to move on to just simple genetic modification, which is easier than cloning, but still complex. And of course, we have beauty companies making claims of turning on youth genes and things like this. But why don't which one day I will do a video on this, but I will be afraid of the product that actually does.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk about what will sort of hit both genetic engineering and synthetic biology, which are different. But Emily, why don't we talk a little bit about genetic engineering? As we know, the roots have come from things we already did, animal husbandry and all, but now we take it to a more sophisticated level where we can target very specific changes in creating an animal, such as the glowing fish. So let's talk about that, how it's useful for science, how the general public benefits, and things like that.
That's a lot of questions. I'm not sure
which to tackle first. It is. Wherever you want to start.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to put it in context, sometimes people ask, how is this different than selective breeding? How does it fit into what we've done before? And I think there are a couple of changes. I mean, one of them is we can target genes with much more precision. We don't have to just, breed two different things together and cross our fingers and hope. We can also make changes much faster than we could do in nature, and we could also make changes that nature would probably never get around to. You're probably never going to get a jellyfish to mate with a cat, but you can now take the GFP gene from a jellyfish and put it in a cat and get a glowing cat. So there are changes in sort of the power we have over other organisms. That doesn't have to be a bad thing, and I spend a lot of time trying to show that it doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, there are all sorts of applications ranging from human and animal health to food, energy. I mean, I'm sure I'm leaving out huge categories of applications, but there are way too many to even list. You can sort of make plants or animals or bacteria do new things that are valuable to us or maybe valuable to them.
So the pharma, the pharma, the farm animals,
right,
drugs in their milk, or, you know, we've had bacteria doing this since the 80s, mm-hmm. right, creating insulin, mm-hmm. but we've moved up to goats and other animals helping to create drugs. So that's useful, and I felt your book did a good job explaining, the sort of the animal rights activist view that, you know, are we harming mm-hmm. the animals, and then, you know, how scientists are actually trying to proactively counter and say, well, no, this animal's fine. In fact, probably better off, you know, this goat creating a lysozyme, extra lysozyme in its milk is probably better off than a goat just wandering around a farm, for instance. So, I mean, the ethical issues of this all is something that would take a whole several other programs. Right. So I don't really want to focus. I like to focus on the science of that. So, so Kyle and Terry, how about your take on, you know, our modifications of, well, first of all, of animals mainly, because we aren't really doing that to humans yet. We aren't genetically modifying humans to our knowledge, right?
Yes, Terry and I aren't.
Good. Speak for yourself, Kyle.
I would also say, just to sort of simplify and summarize what Emily was saying, is that for the public, I think it's important to understand why we're using these tools and what the technologies are potentially good for, and really they're good because it allows us to investigate single genes or groups of genes or genetic changes on multiple levels. So you can look at very, very specific gene changes in a cell or in a whole organism, and that can be really powerful because it does give you that tool to then look at this and say, okay, we modified this, what specific change did that have? And you can see the benefits of that in some of these modified organisms, such as the crops or the farm animals. Like you said, we don't have humans yet, but even if we're not modifying humans with these tools, it can give us knowledge about what genes are doing in humans, and you can create drugs, new therapies based on these findings. You can do a lot of things that are really beneficial without actually modifying the humans themselves. It teaches us a lot.
I'd like Terry to comment and to differentiate genetic engineering from synthetic biology, because that's often very commonly, it's blurry,
yeah,
for most people.
Well, first off, I think there's two things going on when they're talking about animals. One is the animal rights debate in general, is that what experiments should we be doing with animals, genetic or otherwise? The other is more technique-based, in that how is genetic modification of animals using molecular techniques different from other experiments that happen on animals? I think Emily's book, by the way, has a great passage talking about when we breed animals, when we inbreed them specifically to fix traits, we cause a lot of problems. And the health problems of a pure breed dog are significant. And I think there's a quote in there about if a genetically engineered animal had the same problems as an inbred animal, that it would be all over the front page of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not a direct quote, but the difference between genetic engineering and synthetic biology, and I will note that there are people that have been genetically modified. There are a couple of gene therapy trials in clinical trials. And these are effectively, because it's a clinical trial, many of them are for very serious conditions where the addition of a single gene may be beneficial. But most of the people working in synthetic biology, which is sort of differentiated from adding a single gene to see what it does, where typically people are working in bacteria or yeast, and they're creating genetic devices that have many interrelated genes to perform more complex tasks, I would say practically the difference would be genetic engineering is a catch-all term. It means a lot of different things. Synthetic biology is specifically but not exclusively focused on bacteria and yeast, and building more and more complex genetic devices as opposed to maybe the addition of one or a few genes.
While you're there, would you tell a story for the audience, but also for me? I'm diabetic. I'm grateful to E. coli. And the question would be, why in the world would I say that? And I think it's a really interesting story that a lot of people may not know about and would change their view.
So the creation of insulin in E. coli, I think it happened at Genentech in 1978, and it was cleared for release in the early 80s. The data is a little old on this, but it's in one of my lectures. I believe we make 6 tons of insulin per year, and most of that is done in E. coli, and the demand for insulin is just going up. The technique has changed a lot since the way that they originally did it, but the idea would be if you have a material like a protein drug, like insulin, making proteins outside of a cell is very difficult. And if you were example, to give me an extremely well-stocked chemical stock room and say, make insulin using test tubes, I could spend the rest of my life attempting to make half a gram of insulin, and I would probably fail. Mm-hmm. So then you're left taking it from animals or modifying something like E. coli to produce insulin, which it doesn't normally produce. That's one of the major success stories. There are some commodity chemicals like propanediol that are also made mm-hmm. in microbes. And I think that the idea when you're talking to a synthetic biologist is either figuring out ways to turn things on and off under very particular conditions, or to make large amounts of stuff that are hard to make otherwise, but mm-hmm. that society needs.
So the simple connection is something like cells are, in this micro viewpoint, cells are little factories for making proteins based on the blueprints from DNA. And then over here we have the idea, say, insulin, the hormone that's necessary for diabetics because they don't make their own, is a protein. Can we do something to this cell to change its DNA so that now, you know, we've retooled the line, it can start making the insulin, and then we can use that as an easier way than, like, growing it in cows or whatever. And that turned out to be the case, and you're right, that was a very early commercial success, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the first.
Yeah.
Cells are factories for making more cells. Sometimes there are parts of the cell that you might want. But very often what you would want to do, for example, you're never going to see a cat having sex with a jellyfish to make a fluorescent cat. At the same time, you're never going to have a bacteria just start making insulin for no reason. Mm-hmm. But bacteria and yeast are easy to grow. So if you could effectively take a cell that's very good at making cells and put in some DNA, that would make it make more cells plus this thing that you want, mm-hmm. then you would have a factory, a renewable factory, for producing this commodity, this drug, whatever you need.
Yeah.
And that's the exact same idea behind farming with the pH, is to get dairy animals to make some of these human compounds like enzymes or clotting factors, things that are useful medicines, but that are hard to make in cell culture. And the idea is if you put the right piece of DNA in a goat or a cow, it produces milk that's chock full of these proteins mm-hmm. that can then be purified. And a couple of these drugs are now on the market now. I think that's a real growth area for genetic engineering and animal biotech. But there will be more.
The story that you told about the goats who had been slightly modified to produce this valuable protein in their milk was interesting. And I'm sure that some people are going to be terribly scared about the idea of goat's milk having these properties. And I teamed that up with having read a book some time ago. It's like, for 400 years, cows have been used to make smallpox vaccine. This is really nothing new. Animals have been used, and don't blame the goat people, really. And I guess it's a big ethical issue, but it seems rather benign at the moment in a way that villages in South America can have these goats that give milk that help the people living in the village be healthier.
Yeah, I think there are certainly things you can worry about with genetic engineering. Release of certain organisms into the wild is certainly one of them, but this is not an issue that I'm particularly worried about or that I think is particularly high on the list of things to worry about.
Mm-hmm. I think the bottom line there is that living organisms are really optimized for creating these types of biological components. Mm-hmm. If you need a molecule, and it's a biological molecule, you're probably better off getting it from an organism than trying to synthesize it from scratch in the lab. Mm-hmm. We just don't have good techniques for that, and we already have organisms available that are good at doing these things, so you modify them slightly, and you can really get a lot of benefit out of that.
And it's important to note how normalized this is. If you talk from a purely biological point of view, I could say, we're going to offer for babies a liquid solution of nutritional components and a large mixture of nanomachines with various complex purposes. And that's just regular milk.
Yeah.
And the other thing one of the scientists said to me, which is absolutely right, is, sure, you can be opposed to this in the abstract, but if you or one of your loved ones needs one of these compounds, you're not going to turn it down. Not many people are going to turn it down if mm-hmm. this is the way to get the medicine that you need.
So where does the fear of genetic modification, gene manipulation, all of these related biotech things, stem cells, slightly different sources, where does all this come from? Is it the general fear, the Luddite fear of new, unfamiliar things, or is there something more specific about getting a little bit too close to the human thing? And why do people worry about playing God anyway? I don't see what the problem is.
I do think there's a general...
So easy, Jeff. don't ask hard questions.
I would say I do think there's a general Luddite fear. There almost always is at least a little bit with new technologies, and there's good reasons for that, but it is more personal when you're dealing with humans or even animals. I mean, animals and pets can be very personal, and I just think there's sort of a general fear of, well, what does this really mean in terms of what it means to be alive, what it means to be a person, because it seems very unnatural to anyone that's not intimately involved in this type of research. Nature doesn't seem to do these things, so I think people question, are we allowed to be doing this? Should we be doing this? That's my take on it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think there's this... Oh, go ahead.
No, please.
I just think there's this romanticization of this idea of nature that does not, in fact, exist. It's not like there's some pristine jungle out there that we're now modifying. We've modified the earth in so many ways. And you see this in particular when you talk about GM foods. I think people think, oh, non-GM crops are just these pristine, like wild, natural things, when in reality, humans have modified them forever. So I think there's this notion that non-genetically engineered stuff is pure and natural in the way, quote unquote, God intended, but everything is this, at this point, is a product of human meddling, even if it's not with molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a hesitance to for many people to look at humans and living organisms as machines that we can meddle with. Mm-hmm. Even though that's the truth, I think there's mm-hmm. hesitance around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this swings back to a previous point, which is, you were kind of talking about the big picture. One of the challenges in putting my educator hat, in getting these ideas across, is you need to start somewhere. DNA is a great place to start. It just to say, okay, so why do you have four limbs and a head, right? Why do you are you different from another primate? And the sort of beginning of that conversation would be DNA, and then further on you start talking about the subtleties. The education is the process of lying less to students over time. So mm-hmm. a lot of people end that at DNA, and that means that if you're basically saying, I am, if you think that you are the way you are because of DNA, and then people talk about changing DNA, it's basically tying that to somebody's identity, and I think that that is potentially mm-hmm. threatening.
Mm-hmm. That's actually, I like that's interesting. That's true. There's a lot of feel of personal involvement when you start talking about changing someone at this very deep physical level, which they take as some sort of other larger emotional or spiritual level, if you will. So I'm looking at the time and thinking I really would like to talk a little bit about prosthetics and, and other enhancements that include things that aren't necessarily biological, but I saw a little duck has obtained a prosthetic foot that was 3D printed. So let's talk about prosthetics and sensors and enhancing, maybe our ability to see or to hear. So I'll let you guys just have a free-for-all on that one.
Talk.
Talk. Yes, please. Somebody talk.
Okay, somebody goes first. Emily, you get to go first.
All right. I mean, the prosthetic story is a great one. It's I spend a lot of time, obviously, talking about animal prosthetics, but it's all crosses back and forth across species lines, and I spent some time with human prosthetists. Most of the animal work is done by human prosthetists who sort of donate their nights and weekends to this, and I was shocked by the degree to which technology has now entered prosthetic devices. I mean, he had patients coming in all day who had computerized knees. He could plug a USB, like a flash drive, into the patient's knee, then put it into his laptop, and it would feed him all this data about his patient's gait. So, I mean, the idea of, we're long past the days of wooden peg legs and things like that. Prosthetics are just growing by leaps and bounds, and they're increasingly being incorporated with the nervous system. We have sort of brain-machine interfaces now that allow mm-hmm. patients and even some animal patients now to sort of move their limbs just by thinking about them. It's really a sort of whole brave new world for limb replacement. And, so far only being done for patients who need it for medical reasons, but, Kyle and Terry mentioned, maybe a future where people are lopping off their stupid old human arms and replacing them with new and improved bionic ones. So, we'll see.
Well, I mean, so far, nature does a pretty good job of giving us bodies, but there's situations where we need to repair or replace, and enhancement is coming along as well. I think that's going to be something that we see more of. And the evolution of these types of implants and prostheses is pretty fascinating, and it really ties not only into sort of our continued understanding of the body and all the biology that's related, but also other fields like programming, computer science, and particularly material science and mechanics for certain of these types of implants. It's just, if you look at the timeline, looking at a wooden peg leg, well, it was that way because the technology simply didn't exist to make something more complex than that. And the more fancy materials that we have available to us and electronics and all these other components, we really have the ability to start mimicking the body better. Even if we can't do it exactly the same, we can make some really interesting stuff that really can function well as artificial body parts.
The brain-computer interfaces are really amazing. There was an article recently saying that there are 100,000 people that have brain implants now, mostly to treat Parkinson's.
Wow.
But I've seen a number of researchers working on various ways to sort of control robotic limbs. I think from the biomechanics point of view, there's also some interesting stuff going on in building prosthetics that aren't just a single piece of solid material. Many have seen this sort of curved carbon fiber running replacements for limbs. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're built not... Our legs are good at running. And good at running doesn't just mean that they produce a lot of energy, but the sort of mechanics of the limbs are set up so that they're easy to run on. They're easy for our bodies to run on. We don't have to spend too much of our effort and our attention to stabilizing ourselves. There's a lot of tricks that the body, the anatomy of the body has done to make that easier on us. So I think that there's a number of directions that those can go.
But what this, it strikes me that what's going on is that a lot of the things that the public is starting to fear now, the fear is a little bit too late. You know, it's like, oh my God, someday someone will be hooked up to the Matrix via USB. It's like, well, you've got people's knees already hooked up. You've got people controlling limbs with brain interfaces and things like, sorry, if you were going to worry about that, you should have worried about that 20 years ago.
I would say it's never too late to worry. Because that's another, I feel like that's another way of saying you don't get a chance now to engage in that. And that's right. That's not fair. I mean, this is a question not for scientists, but for society. I do think that it's important, if you choose to worry about something, to make sure you're worrying about the right things. Generally, I find that the commonest misconception about these sort of ethical issues is that scientists don't think or worry about things at all. Where in reality, I think it's generally, I do worry about things. I tend to not worry about the same things that I see in the media. That's the difference. I'm worried about the things that I see ahead as things that people might actually do. I'm not worried about 10,000 cloned Hitler armies.
I also would add that I've actually been pretty impressed and happy lately to see the reaction to some of these new technologies. I think that a new thing comes out and there's always going to be someone who's a little worried or concerned about something. So, you know, there was some controversy and some discussion as to whether or not somebody with those artificial blades should be allowed to compete with the other athletes. Mm-hmm. But I think the vast majority of the time nowadays, actually, people see this new thing and the reaction is not, uh-oh, I better get worried that, you know, we're replacing our legs. It's like, wow, we can do that? That's amazing. And we've seen, you know, Terry and I give some talks sometimes and we'll show videos of people, you know, a paralyzed person with a brain-machine interface that's now controlling a robotic arm, and people don't freak out and go, oh, no, what does this mean? They go, that is just simply astounding. Like, they're happy to see these things.
The comment that we often get afterwards is, why have I never seen that before? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't everybody know that that has happened?
Right. But then does that mean that authors, you know, you authors, are starting to make some headway in moving the conversation more quickly into fruitful areas of discussion rather than misplaced fears?
I think the short answer is it depends. I mean, I think we'll see a public embrace of prosthetic devices and bionics long before you know, I'm encouraged about that, but I'm increasingly depressed about the public conversation around GM foods, for instance. So I think it goes both. I think there's progress being made in some areas and definitely a lack of progress and perhaps even regression being made in others. I think it depends.
So, again, being the clock watcher I am today, usually I don't, I'm going to steal Jeff's normal question where it starts to become awkward because we have to wrap things up, but the question Jeff likes to ask, is there anything that we haven't asked that you that's burning that you really want to say before we go off the air, either something about the your books or, you know, the topic in general or about you. So why don't we start with Terry and just go ahead and just and sort of your moment to clarify something or to, you know, or to tell me which movies are going to be in your next book because you're going to have to update it.
I haven't seen Elysium yet, but we were talking about brain interfaces and that might have an interesting one. I would say that one of the things that we need to do, and I'm going to piggyback on Emily's point, is learn to talk about these things in a way that is useful. I think, for example, GMO foods, the things that I worry about are business practices and IP associated with GMO foods, because I think that that's going to have a really significant impact on how these things develop and how they're applied. I'm less worried for other reasons about the safety of existing GMO foods. So really just figuring out better ways to have this discussion. I think some of that's going to involve education, but I think that's going to be the challenge for the next 50 years, is learning how to have a discourse.
Yeah.
I guess just adding my two cents to that, for the people that are, you know, in this discourse and the public listening to this discourse, I'd say, you know, be excited because it's actually a really exciting time to be around. There's a lot of interesting technologies coming out, and also be skeptical, because I'm sure Terry and I will look back at our book 10 years from now and go, ah, a lot of that's not right anymore and it needs an update. And that's the nature of the science, is that I think we try to do the best we can, at least some of us, to educate the public with what we know. And sometimes we don't get it right, and sometimes it's changing. And so just continue the discussion and do it in an appropriate way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm optimistic about these technologies and about the future, but what I sometimes feel like I have to clarify, and that people mistake optimism, or my optimism, for thinking that I'm saying, let's just charge ahead with everything and not worry about it, and everything will be fine. And that's not the same thing. You know, there are certainly dangers here. There are certainly things that can go wrong. There are certainly perhaps products that will be developed that should not be on the market and, you know, should be regulated. And I think there are plenty of reasons to be cautious. But the message I've been trying to get out is that biotechnology is this great tool. And, you know, it's not inherently good or inherently evil. It's up to us now that we have these tools to make choices about how we use them. And we can use them in a lot of great ways, as well as maybe some less productive ones.
I have a question, and this is a quickie, to wrap up, about evil mad scientists bent on world domination, that I think we have the best people here to answer it. I've seen plenty of movies and comics and things that have these evil mad scientists in them bent on world domination. And my question is, why do they always go to the expense and trouble of building secret laboratories that are entirely underground with 30-foot ceilings clad entirely in stainless steel, which is surely not the most economical secret laboratory you could come up with?
Well, I watch a lot of Breaking Bad, and I know that you can set up a lab anywhere, so totally unnecessary to build it underground. You just need to be clever.
Okay.
Are you saying we'll see more scientific labs hidden under laundromats or
in
Arbiters? That's right. Mad scientists are usually pretty harmless. It's mad engineering that is the real issue. A mad scientist is just testing a really weird hypothesis. Most of the time, if you hear someone referred to as a mad scientist, if they're building a giant robot, that's actually a mad engineer.
Thank you for that, Terry.
Yeah.
And in fact, these mad scientists are really working in laboratories built by their friends, the mad engineers, anyway. So I'll work on my question for next time. Yeah.
Well, that's right. So I am so glad that Terry and Kyle and Emily could join us. It was a really interesting discussion, and definitely glad you could all bring something to the discussion that was a little bit different. Definitely, I mean, I really enjoyed both of these books, and they have slightly different audiences, and Terry and Kyle's really uses a lot of pop culture to sort of, and looking at movies to sort of dispel the myths, and Emily's is, you know, really good explainer of how biotech is, you know, being used in animals, you know, as experimental ways, but also enhancement for the animals and then to help humans. So I recommend them both. I've read them both. I love them both. So, all right. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.